Welcome back to the program. In an economy in which over 10% of the population is unemployed, it might be easy if people pursued any job. But in fact, that's a short-term solution to the individual and to the economy. In fact, it's only by pursuing that which we are passionate about that we can change and reshape the fundamentals of work and employment in the 21st century and really reap the rewards of building our economy on true human potential. These are some of the ideas behind The Element, a new book by my guest Ken Robinson. He speaks to more than 50,000 audience members each year. He's worked with governments in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, as well as Fortune 500 companies and nonprofits. It is my pleasure to have Dr. Ken Robinson here to talk about The Element, how finding your passion changes everything. Ken Robinson, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you. First of all, explain what The Element is.
It's two things. When we say people are in their element, I think it means this, that firstly, we're doing something that we have a natural feel for. You know, we get it. And we all get things very differently. You know, we're all good at very different things. I mean, I was thinking recently, you know, I was given a guitar as a kid at about the same time that Eric Clapton got his first guitar. Well, it worked out for Eric. You know, in a way, it didn't quite for me. He got it. Other people get mathematics or they get working with people. You know, it's about, firstly, that it's aptitude. And I think a lot of people don't really understand the range of their own aptitudes. But the second thing is that to be in your element, it's not just finding things you're good at. You have to love it. I know lots of people who are good at things they don't really care to do. But if you love something you're good at, then you really, as I say, you never quite work again after that.
In an economy such as the one we face today with such high unemployment, is there the luxury of pursuing those passions as opposed to the reality of just getting by?
Well, I don't think it's a luxury. I think it's absolutely vital. And it's vital for several reasons. One is that it's really central to our own personal fulfillment. You know, I meet so many people who simply don't enjoy the work they do or the lives they lead. You know, they get on with it. They endure it rather than enjoy it and wait for the weekend. But I also meet people who love what they do and who couldn't imagine doing anything else, and I bet you're one of them. You know, who, if you said to them, don't do this, they think, well, this is who I am.
Right.
And these aren't all high-paying jobs or high-profile jobs or celebrity jobs. I know that's true of people who work in education. They work in community settings. It could be raising their family. It could be working in medicine or, you know, anything. I meet people in all walks of life. So the first thing is, I think finding something that really speaks to who you are is essential to our living a life that adds up to something. But the second is, you know, in these economies where where it's so uncertain, where it's hard to predict where we're headed, where a lot of the old bets are off, I mean, what better time is there to really look back and think, well, what should I be doing? A lot of people are being thrown out of jobs they didn't like doing anyhow. Mm-hmm. And when the future is so uncertain, the best bet, I think, is to back your own talents and to do things that inspire you. So I really don't think that it's a whimsical argument. On the contrary, it seems to me both hard-headed and practical.
Do we have the infrastructure in place in terms of our education, in terms of our human resources opportunities, that really foster this kind of thinking?
No, I think we don't. In fact, that's a big theme of the book. You know, the reason I think that so many people don't find what they love to do or find their own natural talents is very largely because of our education system. And I don't say this in criticism of teachers or head teachers. I've worked in education and around education most of my life. I have huge respect for people who work in education and who teach. But there is something in the system of education which, at the moment, I think is toxic. You know, we are promoting a terrible culture of high-stakes assessment, of standardized tests. The curriculum is being narrowed. Kids are being driven through this system like fodder. And, you know, any parents listening to this will know that their kids go to school when they're little with their eyes bright and full of hope and expectation. By the time they get into their teens and they're in this treadmill of standardized tests, more and more of them have the lights going out in their eyes, and actually more and more of them are dropping out, you know, something like a 30% dropout rate from schools. So this very process that's meant to develop our talents, you know, you might imagine, in very many cases is inhibiting them and ignoring them. And I think it's a major issue. I think it's a major issue for kids, for parents, and I think it's a major issue for the country.
One of the things that we've also seen, and perhaps we saw more of it before the current economic conditions, particularly among young people, is that many of the best and the brightest were pursuing careers for financial reward more than pursuing their passions.
Yeah, that's right. And it's important to be clear about the relationship here. You know, I have a chapter in the book called For Love or Money, and it's simply the case, you know, that some people do find a way of earning their living from the things they love to do. Others don't, and so they run them alongside other things they do. It may be that what they're really passionate about isn't something that they could easily make a living from. And other people choose not to. You know, they say, I mean, I interviewed lots of people for the book who said, look, I love to do this, but I don't really want to do it all day long and have to turn up and be accountable for it. It's finding something in your life that enriches you. And what I find is that when people find things they love to do or that really speak to who they believe they truly are, it changes everything for them. Even work they have to do or responsibilities they have to bear take on a different character when they know there's this other time in their life when they can truly be themselves and do the things that really at the heart of who they believe themselves to be. So it's getting that balance right, you know, between what we do for love and what we do for money. And sometimes it's the same thing and sometimes it's not.
Is this a problem that is indigenous to this country or is it something you find around the world?
Oh, it's absolutely global. And I ought to say that you probably gathered by now, and people listening to this have probably gathered now, that I wasn't born and raised here in Los Angeles. You know, but I've lived here for 9 years. My wife and I and our two kids moved out here in 2001, actually 3 months before 9/11. So our whole experience of living in America has been pretty much since then. But these are issues which, and we're permanent residents here now, you know, but these are issues which are just as important whether you live in Europe, in England, where I was raised, or Australia, or Asia. If you're on Earth, honestly, these are issues that should concern us. I mean, how do we make the most of our human talents? How do we make the best of our children? How do we make the best of our communities? And there's enough evidence around, Jeff, to show that we're not doing a very good job of this at the moment. You know, there's a massive dropout rate from schools. More and more people are, you know, finding their lives aren't ones that they feel have purpose and meaning. More and more people are turning to other kinds of ways of keeping their spirits up. I mean, this is a huge bonanza, you know, for the pharmaceutical companies in lots of respects. And, of course, famously in California, where we all live, listening to this, I'm sure, for a number of years, the state government has spent far more money on the prison system than on higher education. And this is an extraordinary perversion of priorities, really. So I think it's both a very personal issue. It's for you and your kids, if you have them, and your friends. But it's a big issue that concerns all of us.
You talked about the lack of infrastructure in terms of our educational system and how we're ignoring this. What is business doing in this regard? And is there a sense of business today in the 21st century fostering this kind of improved environment?
You know, it's ironic, this, because a lot of the pressures on school systems are being brought about in what politicians often believe are the interests of business and the economy. You know, if you look at how schools are being forced down this route of standardized testing, narrowing the curriculum, I mean, one example of that is that so many schools in the past 10 years in America have cut arts programs out completely. You know, a lot of people listening to this, I'm sure, if they're at the same age as me, and I'm a boomer, you know, but anybody over 40 probably, we'll probably remember when they were at school, they had all kinds of great arts programs, you know, bands and theater and learning instruments. A lot of kids don't have any of that anymore. You know, it's a pretty dreary grind that they have to go through. And if you read the legislation, listen to politicians speak, they say it's because, you know, America has to compete. You know, we have to raise standards, especially of mathematics and science, and we have to kind of knuckle down and cut out the excess. And all this is meant to be for economic purposes. But if you talk to businesses, and I do every year, I travel all over the country speaking to businesses, what they want are people who can think differently, who can be innovative, who can see opportunities, who can take them, who can be flexible. And it's really ironic to me. They say more and more, you know, we get these kids who've actually succeeded in the system, not the ones who dropped out, but the ones who did well, who've gone on maybe to go to college, they've come out with degrees, but we can't get them to think differently. We can't get them to have a new idea because they've come to this culture where all the time they're being asked to say what the one right answer is, and they want to know what the right answer is. So this is why I think it's such an important economic issue. So a lot of businesses are trying to take this into their own hands. You know, they're running their own courses. They run courses on creative thinking, on innovation. And I try to help them do that, and I think it's important that they should do that. I think there's a much bigger issue around how we're thinking about human ability and talent that we have to address across the business and education divide.
Why do you think, in trying to understand that, why do you think this paradox has evolved where our educational system is so out of sync with the needs of the business community in the 21st century?
I'll tell you what I think it is, Jim. I think, well, firstly, it's important, I think, to remember that we haven't had education systems all that long. I mean, I know it sounds like an odd thing to say, but really, before the 19th century, most countries didn't have these massive education systems that were paid for out of taxation, that were compulsory. Very few people actually did get educated. These massive state systems of education came about really to meet the needs of industrialism, of the big industrial economies. And they were designed to meet the needs of the big industrial economies. I mean, I'm 59 now. I was born in 1950. And when I went to school, we were told a story. You know, I mean, I don't mean they sat down and told us it, but it was clearly what we had to understand, which was if you worked hard at school and did well, and particularly if you went to college and got a degree, you would have a job for life. You know, it'd be guaranteed, and, you know, years later somebody would give you a clock. Well, nobody believes that anymore. Nobody thinks if you get a college degree, you automatically get a job or that you'll have it for the rest of your working life, because the world is totally different. The problem is that the current systems of education were designed for a different era. And it was an era in which most people would be doing manual work. That was true of my family. I grew up in Liverpool in England. And a few people would go to college and end up doing jobs in suits and going to an office. It's about 80-20. That was the ratio. Well, nowadays, firstly, the whole economy has shifted. More and more people are doing, so to speak, intellectual work. And it's totally unpredictable. The rate of change is faster than we've ever known in the whole of human history. So what we've got is this old lumbering system of education that was designed for a different time. And I think the problem is that people think that improving education is like bailing out the motor industry. It's like improving a manufacturing process. And the result of it is that more and more kids are just dropping out, and they think, well, this isn't for me, because they're not being treated personally. They're being treated like commodities.
One of the things you talk about is the value of creativity.
Yeah.
And you make the point early on in the book that, you know, you ask kids if they think they're creative and they always answer yes. You ask adults if they think they're creative and more often than not the answer is no. Talk about that.
Well, there's a great story which I love, which I start the book off with, which is of a teacher who was working with a group of six-year-old kids having a drawing lesson. And she said there was a girl in the corner who didn't normally pay attention. And in the drawing class, she did. You know, bear in mind, there aren't many drawing classes these days in schools. So she went over. She was very curious what she was doing. And she said, what are you drawing? And this little girl said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher said, but nobody knows what God looks like. And the girl said, they will in a minute. Well, you see, I love this because what it speaks to is the confidence that kids have in their own imaginations. As they grow up, it tends to decline. And it's in part because, as I say, we have these systems which are very linear and increasingly narrow. You know, I mean, kids these days would be lucky to have a drawing lesson. Now, I don't mean to say that creativity is all about drawing or music or the arts. I mean, those things are really very important for all kids. And I think it's a tragedy when they're cut from school programs, and we really have to think hard about putting them back. But the truth is, you can be creative at mathematics, you can be creative at science, you can be creative at anything, if it's properly taught. And creativity is the process of having original ideas. And developing creativity is absolutely essential. It's essential to the future of the economy. It's essential to create new jobs, new businesses. It's essential to the health of our communities. And it's essential for us to meet all the challenges that we face in our own lives. You know, we're probably facing some of the most challenging periods in human history now, with the challenges with population growth, the strain on the Earth's natural resources, the rate of change with technology. If we educate people only to think in straight lines or not to be able to see new opportunities, we're creating a major problem. And by the way, I know that President Obama gets this. I mean, he's recently spoken at the National Academies of Science and Engineering. and said we have to rekindle the spirit of innovation. He's absolutely right about that. And I've been doing some work with some of the national academies on some strategies they might start to think about. But it's not only about science and engineering, important as they are. It's about fostering creativity in all the things that we do.
Uh-huh.
And for some people, it's in the arts, and it's in music, and it's in dance. And this country, America, has had such an extraordinary growth and period of development over the past 300 years because it's a country that celebrated and fostered innovation and creativity and the opportunity to see new possibilities. And the great danger now is, I think, that we're squashing that very capacity at the time when we probably need it most.
The other aspect of this is that it is antithetical to what current scientific research tells us as we understand more and more about how the brain functions.
Oh, it is, absolutely. I mean, I think that there are really exciting and extraordinary things going on now in the field of cognitive science, of understanding how the brain works. I mean, what we know now is, firstly, that children are born with extraordinary capacities. I always say this, you know, that one of the great things about living in California is it's such a multilingual culture. I mean, we know people who speak 3, 4, 5 languages. And, you know, in Britain, people tend to speak one, you know, English, really. We've kind of got the hang of that. If you go to Europe, people speak several languages. The thing is, it isn't that people in California have a better grasp of languages than, you know, in Liverpool. It's that we are surrounded by people who speak lots of languages. So if a child is born into a house where lots of languages are spoken, they just learn all of them. They just take them in through their skin, if they're young enough. But if you're born into a house where one language is spoken, you learn that one. And then when you're older, it's much harder to learn a second language. Now, my point is that we have these fantastic capacities from the minute we're born. And it's about using them and developing them. We have tremendous capacities which we never find out about, which we never get to. And neuroscience is showing us the range and extent of that. What it's also telling us is though, that we can continue to develop our natural capacities, our physical capacities in the brain throughout the whole of our lives. You know, it isn't that we are born with, you know, all of these brain cells and we just lose them as we get older. We can create infinite pathways and connections between our brain cells. I think we have about 100 billion neurons in our brain, about 100 billion brain cells. But there's an infinite number of ways of connecting them all up. And the more we do, the richer our experiences are, the more we challenge ourselves, the more flexible, the more creative our minds become as a result.
Is there a way, in your view, to take the current infrastructure of education that we have and really turn that around, or is this something that we really have to start anew?
Well, I think there's a lot we can do starting tomorrow. You know, if you're a parent, or any parents listening to this, you know that if you've got two children, they are both different. I don't even have to know your kids to know that's true. I mean, I have two children. Even if you've got identical twins, you know they're different. I mean, they may be similar in lots of ways, but often they're just also very, very different. Almost always they're very different. And parents understand that. They understand that they have to treat their kids as individuals. What happens when they go to schools increasingly is they're treated like a pack. And the individuals start to get disaffected. All of them have that risk. You know, there's a big concern with raising reading standards, but it's all being done through these remorseless standardized tests. And I can't think there's a kid in California who gets out of bed in the morning wondering what they can do to raise the state's reading standards. You know, they will be interested if it interests them. You have to engage people personally. We know that. It's true of our own lives. Think back to when you were at school. What you remember, I'm sure, are the teachers, the people who connected with you, the ones who turned you off. So, yes, I think there's a lot we can do, but we have to recognize that education is a personal process, and you have to individualize it. And that all the great schools, and there are very many of them, are great, and they're all different. It's like all great restaurants are all great, but they're all different. If you go to fast food restaurants, you know, they're not as good, in my opinion or experience, but they're all identical. You know, you can go to any of your favorite fast food outlets around the state, and they're all the same. I mean, I think they're not very good for you, by the way. That's my personal opinion.
Right.
You know, and they're creating the worst outbreak of diabetes and obesity in the history of the earth. But hey, you know, they're all guaranteed. But all the great places, you know, like all the great radio shows, like your show, what people tune in for is not because it's the same as every other show, but because there's something individual about it. It's your voice, they like, your opinion, your take on things. And it's true for everything that we do. So I think what we have to do is recognize the need for high standards, but all schools need to start to customize what they do to the children that they're working with and to recognize the creative capacities of the teachers in helping them do it. It's what families try to do. So I think there's a lot we can do, but we have to start the other end. It's not about making everything the same. It's about helping to make things different.
Can we do that in a way that is scalable to a population that is as large and as diverse as ours?
It's the only way to do it, Jeff, in my opinion and experience. It's the only way to do it. Because, you know, kids who go to school in the morning, they don't go to school in every, you know, one child who gets up in the morning, goes out the front door, isn't going to every school in the state. They're not going to visit every school in the country. They're going to their school. And that's education for them. What happens when they walk onto the school campus and go and sit in their classroom? That is education. And that's true for the millions of kids at school across the country. Every kid is going to one school, and they're having their day with their teachers. And the way you improve education is to improve that experience in that school with these kids. And if we all do it in the places we work in, then the whole country starts to lift. The problem, I think, with national policies is there's always been a tendency to say, look, let's make it the same for everybody. It's like the fast food industry. You know, it's like trying to apply the same principle. Let's just standardize everything. And the result is what we see now. 30% of kids are dropping out. It's 50% of kids in some of our neighborhoods, some of our low-income communities. In the Native American communities, it's as high as 80% of kids dropping out from school. Well, at this point, you can't blame the kids. You can't blame the teachers. This is the system. So there's something wrong at the heart of it. And I think what's wrong about it is it's impersonal, and it's being confused with a manufacturing system. And as soon as we recognize it's a human system, it's about people, making them feel comfortable, valuing them, seeing who they are, seeing their real talents, that will begin to transform. That's absolutely scalable, but it's scalable in the way that things become viral. You know, it's not scalable in the sense of trying to turn out the same light bulbs. It's scalable in the sense of growing plants. And if we recognize the business we're in, that it's more like agriculture than manufacturing, then I think we'll see this blossom across the whole country.
What is it that is in the current system that makes it so much more difficult, as you've talked about, for those on the bottom end of the economic ladder, and how can the system be adjusted so that it takes those people into account and creates more success with those people that are dropping out that you talked about before?
Well, you know, there are all kinds of reasons why people drop off the end of education. And they're not all just at the low-income end, by the way, although it's a major problem there. You know, there are plenty of kids I know in affluent areas, too, who just decide they've had enough of this. And I don't mean all. I'm not saying, by the way, that every child, you know, hates education. On the contrary, some people do really well in the current system because it's designed with certain sorts of things in mind. I'll tell you what it's designed for, actually. The whole process of education at the moment is designed to get kids to college. Now, people might say, well, yes, of course it should, but not everybody, you know, needs to go to college. Not everybody wants to go to college. Not everybody buys it. You know, people have very different talents and very different interests. I know people who've wanted their entire lives to be doing a job that didn't require them to go to college, and they've loved the lives they've had as a result. But it's this thing that if you don't go to college, your life is over somehow, and I just don't believe that. I think we have to think very hard about that. A lot of kids go to college, they do very expensive four-year degrees, and then they don't know what to do next. You know, they go home and start hanging around the house again because they haven't got any kind of a plan. That's what I mean about selling people the wrong story. But there are plenty of people in low-income areas, you know, who see no prospects of it. Even if they wanted to go to college, they think, well, I'll never be able to afford it. They're often in schools which have low expectations of them. They often have difficult family backgrounds they have to contend with. And, of course, the old story that you and I were told, which was if you work hard and go to college and get a job and get a degree, you'll have a job, most kids don't think that's true anymore. They know that isn't necessarily the way that their lives will pan out and that they could, if it's just about earning money, there are other things they could do right now to earn it. So, you know, there are lots of reasons why people fall out, but you can't meet them with a single answer. My point really is that you have to individualize it. I know great school systems, great programs where people have been reconnected with education, but in every case, it's because somebody took an interest in them personally and didn't treat them as a trend. They treats them as a human story, as a life. And interesting, all the so-called remedial programs, all the programs designed to get people back with education, are small groups with individualized teaching. And if we'd only done that in the first place, very few of them would have dropped out, probably.
Ken Robinson. The book is The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. It's just out from Penguin. Ken, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a real pleasure, Jeff. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.